ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan. And once again, we are living in a world where the Perth Scorchers are the BBL champions on the back of their win last night. We'll pull apart that game from every angle. And there's a whole lot of talking points coming out of it. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm in the sporting capital of the world in Melbourne. And Ed Cowan is back in the Harbour City after a little time on the coast. How are you, Teddy?
I'm well, Corb. I'm just so excited that after the entire Big Bash, if we go back to our predictions, I did so well 10 weeks ago to predict that the Perth Scorchers were going to be the champions. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing crystal ball to have, isn't it?
Wow. This is modern politics, but that's revisionist history big time out.
Fake news, you reckon?
Yeah, in the way that that's been reconstructed. But holy smokes.
For those that don't play along at home, I think I tipped them for the wooden spoon.
I definitely think you did, judging by my mentions on Instagram and Twitter and everything else. Our Sydney Sixers, unfortunately, losing the final last night. There's a whole lot of talking points to come out of it. Just give me a big broad brush off the top. Was it a success? Was it a successful tournament overall? So, yeah, hats off to the winners. We'll get to them in just a moment. And the dynastic run they've put together for 15 years now. But has it been a good addition of the tournament?
Yeah, I think so. I think if we look back, you know, a bit more broadly, a couple of years ago, it was pretty easy to see that the Big Bash was in decline. I think it stabilised for a year. And probably the moment it went to 10 home and away games was probably the moment it started to inflect, and we've now had a couple of seasons of that, and it does feel, between the energy of the live audience, you know, having been to a couple of games that were superb, the TV audiences, still think the quality of the cricket could get a little bit of a boost, but, you know, given that it doesn't really have any competition now that the tennis has moved back a week, I really feel like it was a pretty good tournament.
Not to rain on its parade straight off the top, because I agree with you. I think we've had more 100 makers than we've ever had in the tournament. I think at the end of the day, yes, we want to see a battle between bat and ball, but yeah, it's short form cricket. We want to see the ball go over the fence, and we've seen some explosive innings this year, and we've certainly that's been provided to us in a way that really it hasn't in the past. And as a result, it's had some established stars. It's pulled it along. It's also been able to create some new ones as well, which is what the tournament is all about. It got beaten last night in a TV rating standpoint. So Alex de Minaur up against Alexander Bublik in his fourth round matchup. So got edged out for an average audience nationally, and tennis actually won the week against the cricket after the cricket started well. So the qualifier, which was the Scorchers Sixers game on the Tuesday night, beat the tennis, and it actually has held its own. And this has been a win for cricket given where it's come from in recent years, but did get edged out last night for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if it was an Australian playing in the tennis, whether or not that would have flipped on its head for sure. But I'm glad you brought that to the table, because yeah, I do feel it's on the improve, but I don't yet think it's the product that it should be or could be, you know, for a whole variety of reasons that we've covered 50 million times on this podcast.
Yep. We'll get into some of those too, with the looming sale of some of the BBL franchises, whether it's 49% or 100% or whatever that turns out to be. I'll ask you some questions about that as we work our way through. So the Scorchers win. They've now won twice as many titles as any other franchise. It's been an incredible run. So six titles, three in the last five seasons. So if you felt like this, you know, the days of the Scorchers dominating were over, we're living through another great dynasty. They've really had multiples of them, really the two different versions, one under Langer and now one under Voges. But three in the last 5 years makes it six titles overall. They win by six wickets last night with 15 balls to spare. No doubt that clearly the best team ended up winning the tournament, and that was probably reinforced last night by what we saw from them. Wasn't a dynamic game of cricket. I text you on the run last night, and I wonder how much of that, given it was a low-scoring affair, how much of that was to do with the deck? Like, what happened to the days of these, you know, glassy, white pitches where the ball, you know, kicks and carries through and everything else, and yet we've got this straw-coloured wicket, and it felt like everyone last night, or particularly the batsmen, struggled with the slow nature of it. It's, you know, it's not the pitch I'm accustomed to seeing, certainly in Perth, but even more broadly around the country.
Yeah, I think the wicket in Perth has been a little bit of an outlier this year, and I think the stats support that. I think it's been the lowest scoring venue of any venue, and that is the inverse of how it has been in previous years. So a couple of things come to mind. So it's not, it was a pretty turgid game of cricket. The Scorchers,
yeah,
you know, totally outplayed the Sixers. We can come to that. I thought the Sixers, again, were very poor with the bat. And basically, it's exposed that they've had one batsman, and he just happens to be the by the name of Steve Smith. The rest have struggled full stop. I think it's been a little bit of a ploy from the Scorchers, actually. I think it's in some intentionality to it, knowing that the way they've set up their team, you know, that they are now a very strong batting lineup and their bowlers need some support. You know, if you look through that bowling lineup, you don't see any real danger. I thought they did very well last night in the conditions, but they've learnt the conditions and now play to the conditions and set their whole team up for that type of game of cricket. So
for
they
someone,
were excellent given the conditions.
For someone like me, Teddy, I mean, you're the cricket guy, but I would have thought, given the weapons that they possess from an attacking standpoint and all their batsmen, why wouldn't you want a fast, hard, bouncy pitch where you think, you know, with Mitch Marsh and Finn Allen and these kind of guys, like, isn't that their best chance to win? I mean, if they could make, you know, 200, 230 and, you know, there's no team that's ever going to be able to get close to them.
Yeah, but the inverse of that is the other team makes 200 or 230 and you know, then it's not even a toss of the coin. That comes down to pure luck whether you can chase that down. Where if you can guarantee that the scores are going to be somewhere between 135 and 150,
yeah,
you're going to back those high quality players to get that in those conditions more often than not. So I think it just takes the element of the other side dominating with the bat, basically, knowing that they can bowl well in those conditions and they can bat in those conditions. So all the more dues to them, because these are foreign conditions for a lot of the local players. This is not a standard Perth wicket at all. And yesterday, you know, even more so than it has been all season. So, look, they were excellent. They're well-drilled. They're highly skilled. They've got a great lineup, and they played to their strengths. So they were by far the better team last night.
What on to David Payne? You sort of highlighted this last week where you said, hey, they carefully select their imports to basically fit their needs, and they're not necessarily sort of name brand guys in world cricket. And there was the joke getting around about the fact that this is a guy that, you know, bowls fast left arm orthodox deliveries off a long run, and his teammates give him a bit of stick and basically say you should just come off a couple of steps bowling those. And yet he was effective on that wicket last night, 3 for 18, and walked away with the man of the match award. The other one's Finn Allen, where you think about, you know, his tournament last year compared to his tournament this year. And last year it looked like he was almost overmatched in this competition, and he averaged 18 for the tournament. They stuck with him. They gave him a second year. This year he averages 42 at a strike rate of 184 and showed why he's the world-class top-order player that he is.
Is that the most dominant tournament we've seen in the Big Bash from an international? Like, I can't think through the, 15 iterations of someone dominating a tournament like he just did as consistently as he did. That is a huge amount of runs at a strike rate that is actually hard to fathom. It's not... If you think about Glenn Maxwell's career, you know, you put him on the absolute top of the tree when it comes to T20. Different roles, admittedly.
Yeah.
But strikes at 155. This is someone who hit more sixes than anyone in the history of the tournament in a season. And it's a shorter season than it ever has been.
Yep.
On a wicket that we've just said has been the lowest scoring wicket, so half his games were played at home.
Yeah,
what the Scorchers did do, they cashed in, you know, when they played away from home. But I just can't think of a name. Maybe Rashid Khan when the strikers were hot, but
certainly not with the bat though.
That's a big name.
Yeah, no, it's a great shout out. What on to Ashton Turner too? I mean, fifth title that he's won. So he's played in 5 of the 6. He's also captained now 3 of them, which no one else has done that. So another record for him. And then you look at the guys that missed out, and he very quickly last night went to, you know, put a light on someone like Joel Parris, for example, who had taken 11 wickets at 16. He missed out on 3 previous titles, and he missed out on being in the 11 again last night after having a groin injury back on January 7, and unfortunately for Joel, that's been a little bit of the story of his career. There was also guys like, you know, Matt Kelly and Lance Morris and Ashton Agar. So all of a sudden, there's a whole lot of guys that would help them, you know, to borrow a baseball phrase, in their bullpen that weren't fit and available and ready to go. That only would have made this team stronger.
Yeah, that's scary. But it spoke to not just the depth, but the quality of cohesion when those players did get a chance. Because, you know, the names that pop up as the replacements don't strike you as incredible T20 players, and yet they played their role, whether it's, you know, a pain as an overseas, as you just described. And that's a really curious case, because you talk about the slow left-arm orthodox. He still has the ability to bowl a fast bouncer. And so the change of pace is up, not down. And the Sixers, you know, failed to kind of react to that. But it's pretty skilled bowling, what he does. You know, he is someone who can generate pace. I played county cricket with him many years ago, and he bowled fast swingers. And, you know, someone who realised his body wasn't going to allow for that, and there was an incentive to do what he does and do it as well as he does. So it's a pretty incredible story in of itself.
Will Voges coach his team next year?
If he wants to, I reckon the job's his. Obviously, so the context being for listeners is he stepped away from coaching WA. I still think two things. He still wants to coach in franchise cricket, and
yep.
You know, this is the second, third or fourth biggest franchise competition in the world. And he has a great team that, you know, is winning, and so it's hard not to want to coach that. I still think he probably harbours desires to coach Australia, and you know, depends what happens with Andrew McDonald. But you'd be a brave man to say that Adam Voges doesn't coach next year, is the flip side of that question.
I hope he does. It would mean that WA, though, are looking for a coach, obviously, just for, you know, Shield cricket and one day... the One Day Cup, which they got a couple of great options. Yeah, guys like Bo Casson and Tim McDonald that have been part of this setup for a period of time now, which would you do an excellent job. So I think if they can keep Voges involved somehow in this program, that he has been WA cricket's most successful coach. I mean, and there's been some great coaches over the journey, whether it's Justin Langer or Wayne,
Tom Moody,
Wayne Clark, Mickey Arthur, all these guys that have passed through WA at different times and had struggled to sort of get the success that Voges has had. But what a run that he's had and been the most decorated coach WA cricket's ever had. By the way, I think that if there's a supporter base in the country, so yes, they win, and these two things I'm sure are hand in hand, but I feel like it means more to people in Perth than just about any other market. And so I'm glad for them that people wake up today in Perth feeling good about themselves. I'm a native Sandgroper. And to sort of to see how much it means to the place. I mean, 55,018 was the crowd last night. And, I mean, my social media feed, as you can imagine, all the people I know from Perth, is lit up of people at the cricket that are taking their kids along now that I'm, you know, in my mid-30s or whatever, and that's kind of their experience at the cricket. And it means a lot to them that their team wins. And I look around the country and I think, I don't think it affects the mood of Sydney today, for example, that the Sixers lost, and if the Thunder made it, it wouldn't have been the same thing. You know, people in Western Sydney, it feels like, engage very differently with the team, and it's very much star-driven in that part of the world that they would rather come out and watch, you know, big-name players as opposed to really get behind their team. Yeah, Melbourne, I feel like, people don't know whether they barrack for the Stars or the Renegades, and it feels like they... care for one as much as the other and don't care about either of them in certain times. You've got the Brisbane,
more the latter, yeah.
You got the Brisbane Heat, who I lived in Brisbane for a period of time, and they get behind winners sort of more than anyone else, but they'll switch between the Broncos and the Reds and the Heat and sort of whoever's doing well at any one particular time. But, you know, if the team's not strong, it doesn't really pull down the vibe of the city. The Strikers, I mean, you front up with that kind of lineup, and I think they were pretty realistic that they're still pretty happy in the days of, looking back on what Travis Head did on New Year's Eve and Rashid Khan brought to them for a period of time, but they were never a contender to win it. The only place that's probably comparable but a much smaller population is Hobart. So, in a way, awesome for Perth that they've got this kind of team to rally behind, because they're a city that kind of gets behind their team really more than anywhere else.
Yeah, I'm unsure you're doing the Brisbane Heat supporters justice. I've always found them the maybe just a half turn down to the parochialism of the Western Australians. And a question for you is, do you think it's because they feel divided in their football tribalism that they feel united in their cricket version of that?
Yeah, I saw all the jokes kicking around the WhatsApp groups and stuff today too about... Yeah, this is why Fremantle supporters get behind the Scorchers so much, because they've had 30 years without a flag, and this team's won six titles in 15 years. But that's a great point. I mean, but they do the same with the Perth Wildcats. Like the Wildcats are so popular, year after year, and they're successful. But I mean, it is very much, as someone that grew up there, I feel like I can say it. It's that sort of chip on your shoulder, you know, us against them type mentality. Yeah. And I'm about to put my sort of WA cap on in just a moment for something else we're going to talk about. But I think that's all baked into it, and it is nice that it brings all your hardcore sports fans together as opposed to you know, the two-team town that it is for the winter months.
And you feel it as a player. Nowhere have I ever been more intimidated than playing domestic cricket in WA and the old Wacker ground. I made my debut, quick sidebar story, on the New Year's Day one-day game. So that was the equivalent of the big bash game that they play on New Year's Day. And it was, people were literally hanging from the rafters, and I think I got spat on. I've never felt being hated so much despite being Australian. It was wild.
People reading the name on the back of your shirt and yelling out to you and everything else that goes along with it.
It was feral. It was so feral.
Yeah. 2005, wasn't it?
It was a good game of cricket. So Brett Lee, my lasting memory, that was Brett Lee. He was 12th man for every test that summer. And he got released to play the New Year's Day game. And he hit Adam Voges in the helmet. It clipped the helmet and hit the side screen on the full for six leg byes, I think.
Jeez. That's a scary proposition on...
It was. But it was great. Mike Hussey was playing, Brett Lee, we had Haddon, Brackett. Like, it was a proper game of cricket. Way back, I mean, now we're really regaling olden days.
I remember watching Warnie there in a Shield game, and there was, like, hardly anyone in the venue, and there was this guy just yelling out abuse to Warnie all day, and at one stage between overs, it was in the last session, he turned and walked over to the grass hill and basically pointed his finger at him and essentially said, "Listen here, mate, I'm out here playing Shield."
Leave me alone.
I don't need you badgering me all afternoon. And sure enough, the bloke didn't say anything after that. But that was a
Warnie could have been living in New York instead of copying abuse from some fan at the Wacker. Who remember the Scorchers fan who used to paint his face with a big beard? I think he may well have been asked not to attend any more fixtures.
I think there was there was a bit of a milkshake duck sort of episode there that he sort of his popularity soared and then fell off a cliff pretty quick. Steve Smith, you mentioned him before. So 12 of the last 14 games he's played for the Sixers, he's top scored. That's insane. 12 of the last 14. And really, I mean, I feel like in a way you almost want to give credit to the Sixers today because it feels like they overachieved where their level was. I mean, they were an ordinary team that when Steve Smith came back in, he almost single-handedly dragged them into being a team that competed for the title. They didn't have any right to be doing that, and it showed when he missed out or he wasn't able to, you know, go large, all of a sudden they looked like an also-ran.
Yeah, I think you've just hit the nail on the head. I think for the first half of the season, I think we called them Dad's Army. They looked slow. They looked a bit out of touch with the modern game. They looked out of form. And it wasn't until Steve Smith came back and really set that batting order alight. And so, you know, there was no real surprises that when he missed out, you know, in the last two games in Perth, that the Scorchers were way too good. So, you know, the Sixers have won three titles, but they've now played in five losing finals. And, you know, it almost feels like this is the moment that they might need to rewire how they line their team up, because it's not, at the moment, I don't think it's good enough to win a competition. And that's not a good place to be in. When you start a tournament and you look down the line, or you look at your tactics and you think you're not quite good enough to win it. And so if you roll forward with the Sixers, Smith and Stark don't play next summer. So people kind of forget that you get in the habit, at the end of the test summer, the test players come back. Well, not next year. So, you know, four tests against New Zealand, straight into a tour, a five-test tour of India. And so none of those test players at this point in time will be playing in the Big Bash. So if you look at the Sixers specifically, you think, oh, goodness, what are they going to do? So there are going to be some hard decisions to make, for sure. But, you know, you talk to the who was sitting on the pine for the Scorchers or unavailable, and there was like a little shot at the dugout last night. Silk, Hayden Kerr, Todd Murphy. You know, there were three big players that you thought, I think all three players would probably add something to the team as it lined up last night. And so I think they just need to sit down and actually start with a blank sheet of paper. I think they've been a bit stuck in their ways.
Yeah, I mean, they were second, but they were a long way second, weren't they? And even last night, it felt like looking unless Steve Smith...
They were a lucky second. If Smith doesn't get 100 against the Thunder, if he doesn't play, they don't win that game. And then you can think about all the other fixtures you played in. There's a world where they finish seventh and, you know, they get really hardwired to have a reset.
Do you know what I hated last night? And, you know, I mean, it's been almost 10 years since I've, coming up 10 years since I lived in Perth. So I like to think I'm, and if anything, I'm accused sometimes of letting my sort of parochialism for Western Australia go, because I don't sort of buy into all the chip on your shoulder conspiracy theory type stuff that that often comes out of there. But I couldn't cop any of the conversation about, you know, the travel and all the rest of it that went into it. I mean, Perth are part of this competition. That the competition was set up this way. They've always been good. They've always been a chance to try and host the final. And yet the sort of the amount of crying that happens on the East Coast about, you know, oh, we've got to, you know, fly back to Perth and we've got to go twice in a week and whatever it turns out to be and how that impacts the side. Well, finish higher. Like, I mean, that we knew at the start of the tournament.
Who's crying? Hang on, back a step. Who's crying? Daily Telegraph or something today.
The amount of, I mean, even in the broadcast, you could hear, you know, how many times that it was mentioned. And how about this quote from Greg Shippard, by the way, who's been around a long time and he knows how the media game works. So no matter how many times you mention, hey, credit to the Scorchers and everything else, if you're going to bring this up, it's going to be a headline and an article. So he went on to say, it wasn't ideal. Some of the scheduling was not what we were looking for. We thought perhaps there could have been a day spaced the first time we came here out of Brisbane. So basically saying, hey, we could have, you know, pushed this back a bit and played on the Wednesday as opposed to the Tuesday. Back to Sydney, of course, and back again. You don't get the chance to train the day before the game, which I would have thought not many other sports are letting that happen at the elite level. We feed some feedback to headquarters. I think we were the only team to provide feedback to Cricket Australia on the schedule.
Well, my mind goes to the fact that the Scorchers were bundled out for 130 and the Sixers proceeded to absolutely fumble the ball over the in-goal line, you know, five or six times in that original final, and they had a chance not to have that return fixture. So it was in their court. Sure, they didn't get a training day before, but if you think of all the big sports around the world, baseball play 160 games a season. They aren't doing much training between fixtures. They're flying in and playing that same day in some cases, and the same with the NBA. So maybe I understand there's some variability on bounce and wickets and et cetera, but I think the modern player is pretty adept to getting in there. If anything, I think the time zone hurts more than you can imagine because, you know, when you're kind of in and out of time zones, but, you know, the corresponding argument against that is they're playing at 4 o'clock anyway. So back in the day when you were playing that late game in Perth, for instance,
10 o'clock start or whatever on the body clock.
Yeah, well, you know, the day-night game, you start at 7 local time, so you're not finishing till 1 or 2 o'clock Eastern time, then you're flying back and play. That's what kills you. But the 4 o'clock start, that's just a normal 7 o'clock. You don't actually need to even adjust.
But this commentary never comes up when it's the other way. It's never like, oh, Perth, they've had to travel so much. It's almost like that's just the price of doing business. Given that you're based on the West Coast, and when it happens the other way, it just feels like the amount of hand wringing that we hear about it. And you think, mate, it kind of is what it is. That's the competition that you're in.
Yeah, I'm kind of agnostic to the comments.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't think it was a great moment. I thought, and you can imagine the headlines today. You know, ship it on schedule and everything else. I mean, the answer in that moment, as much as I love the fact that, you know, he's asked a question, he answers honestly. That's probably what it is. You know how the headlines are going to be in that kind of moment. It's you know, Sixers grizzle about the schedule or whatever, having just been beaten in a title. I wouldn't have thought that's the day to sort of offer any kind of opinion on what that looks like, other than, hey, they were the better team, we got beat.
I thought what you were going to say when you opened the conversation saying, you know, it's something I don't like, I was going to jump in and say, when you catch the ball and you have to get up somehow from the ground, but if one little fleck of white leather touches the grass, having taken an absolute screamer, it's now not out. I thought that's where you were taking this.
It's just shocking for our game, isn't it? Like, it's just, and it's such a boring conversation, and there'll be someone that'll come out and be like, oh, but the letter of the law, he hasn't controlled the ball and everything else. Like, are we going to just get to a point where we go, you know what, we're just going to survey 10 people. We're going to find 10 people, we're going to show them the catch, and then we're going to find a consensus of whether we think that's out or not. And if you find 10 people that have played cricket from, whether it's in the backyard or in the local park or in community cricket, 10 out of 10 people are going to say, yep, that's out, that's a catch.
I mean,
it can't be that hard, can it?
So I agree. So I don't believe in the other side of the argument, but what I'll give is the way it is currently constructed is the easiest way to take the grey out of it. It's black or white. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the the laws of the game should be written so that they can be interpreted in a black and white manner. Otherwise, we have too much interpretation and it gets too hard. And so what does controlling the ball actually mean? You know, have you come to a stop? I think, you know, the only thing that will change it, and we can whinge about till the cows come home, is someone gets badly hurt. And the closest we came was Ashton Turner. If you're running back and he took a catch and he put himself, if he didn't put his hand back, he would have knocked himself out cold. Or someone pops their shoulder out trying to keep their shoulder rotated with their palm faced up, and, you know, it's Mitch Stark and he can never bowl again. Australia's greatest ever white ball bowl. You know, so there will be an event that we go, oh, actually, the player safety is actually more paramount. And it's pretty clear if you have control of the ball, if it's sitting in your hand,
yep,
and you're not using the ground to control it. So this is the alternate version of what you could before. Last night, he catches the ball, palm up, straight in the hand. And as he's sliding to push himself up off the ground, Cooper Connolly puts the ball on the ground. He's still moving, yes, yep, but he's not using the ground to stabilize the ball in his hand. So if the umpire determines that the ground is used as a mechanism to stabilize the ball in the ground, then that should be, I think, the determinant whether it's out or not. Because we've gone, in my opinion, too far. It makes it defeats the purpose, and we're actually missing out on amazing catches.
Yep.
Like, we should be celebrating that as an unbelievable hanger in the outfield, and the crowd should go up, and away we go. So imagine I don't love it. Oh. I understand why, but that doesn't mean that it's right.
No. Imagine if you came from, like, the United States or from some, you know, non-cricket playing part of the world, and you saw that last night, and then you saw replay after replay after replay, and you're sitting in the stands, you're thinking, what are they doing? And then you have to have someone explain to you next year, oh, by the way, yeah, he hasn't fully controlled it, the grass hit the... And then the batsman runs back out. Like, it looks terrible for the sport. Yeah. Like, for something that, you know, 10 out of 10 people or 9 out of 10 or 99 out of 100 or whatever high percentage it is, people think, yep, that's a catch. There'll be someone out there to say, oh, brush the ground and the MCC and the laws of cricket.
And it ruins that authentic moment of seeing someone take a, you know, go horizontal, running back... Crowd goes wild, and then so what will start happening? The crowd will stop celebrating. They'll be like, oh, and then just take a breath and wait for it to go upstairs, and it kind of ruins the moment of that live experience while you're at the ground.
We've already done that with the DRS, which, yeah, by the way, used exceptionally last night by the Scorchers. Like, I mean, more often than not, we barely even see a review because the players only have one. They don't review as often as they should. If I was a captain of a T20 team, Teddy, every time there's an LBW shout, I'm using it because there might not be another chance to use it. Like in 20 overs of cricket, where there's so few opportunities, and good on them for using it last night against, you know, the best T20 player in the competition, and it came up their way.
It did come up their way. It was an unbelievable review. I think to the naked eye, you're like, ooh, that's close, and then you thought, ooh, that's high, and then you thought, oh, that's out. And, you know, that was, I guess, we've already talked about the Sixers without Smith. I think that's worth rolling the dice every day of the week, you know, considering he literally was their backbone to any chance of victory.
At the risk of flogging a dead horse, I can't get past it, the Sixers comments about the schedule and everything else.
one more thing
before I move on from it, right? Okay. I didn't hear anyone from the Sixers suggest that, hey, by the way, after we lost our major semi-final, we're going to play our home prelim in Perth. So instead of going back to Sydney to save travel, don't laugh, instead of saving time on the travel, we're going to stay here and we're going to wait for the team to fly and play us. It's our home final. We want to play it in Perth. And if we win, that's going to give us the best chance to try and beat the Scorchers on Sunday, knowing that it's back here. No one suggested that. Shippy wasn't out there saying, hey, by the way, you know, Cricket Australia, can we please play in Perth as a result? We're going to do it because we don't want to fly there and back. It's too much travel. Where was that suggestion?
That is too good. That was not what was on my dance card.
There was no suggestion about that.
That is good.
If it's that much of an issue, anyway.
I love that.
I'm bent out of shape.
You should be passionate about so many other issues, and yet this is the one that it's bubbled to the surface. I love it. Where has this been?
It's that sort of deep thing when you're born in WA. It's somewhere in there that I didn't think it would come out of me in this moment. But here we are. Before we move on from the BBL, obviously you wear multiple hats and you're a very talented man. You're inside cricket deeply. And so last time we spoke about the potential sale of the BBL, you essentially told me, and I'm careful here because you are on the board of Cricket New South Wales and there's only so much you can say. But I've heard more and more reports and you know, everything gets kicked around in the media or whatever about, you know, potentially six of the eight teams will be sold 49%. The other two will be sold 100%, obviously, with eyes on the Renegades and the Thunder. Now there's reports about New Zealand's going to be prioritised to expand the competition as opposed to Canberra. Have you heard any more yet from Cricket Australia? You don't necessarily have to tell me what it is, but have the states had more instruction yet from CA as to what this potential sale is going to look like?
Well, I mean, you've just summarised what has been put out publicly, so I guess I can comment on that. And, you know, the states are in constant dialogue with Cricket Australia as to what this looks like, and there's, you know, now information available as to how that plays out. So I think maybe the only thing that caught people a little bit off guard was, you know, this question of expansion and a New Zealand team. You know, I don't necessarily think the Big Bash is prime for expansion at this point in time. You know, sport is so infatuated with growth. There's all, and particularly when you're talking about private investment, you always, if someone pays a number, X, they are trying to make 3X. And the only way to make 3X is for something to grow, unless you buy it very cheaply. And these won't be sold cheaply if they get sold at all. And so there has to be this little carrot somewhere that says, hey, this league is going to be bigger, and that's going to increase the media value of the Big Bash.
The gate's higher, kind of, all the rest of it.
Exactly, but if you kind of dig in, and you know, why New Zealand makes sense is it's a new time zone. It doesn't dilute the talent pool. So you could have, you know, New Zealand players playing as locals right throughout the competition, not just for the New Zealand team. But, you know, aside from their actual national players, I'm unsure that they wouldn't be dilutive, and so you'd have to do an agreement there. But if you think about, there are 4 or 5 million people in New Zealand, it's the same size as a little bit smaller than Sydney. And so does one new audience of 5 million people really jack your media rights up that someone has the potential to earn 3X on their investment? Because the other issue is, you know, the states rely on both the profit and the funding from these Big Bash teams. And if that's going out the door to someone else, how do you rewire the whole system to ensure that the states are no worse off? Because I guess the point I'm trying to make is you add another team, your denominator is one more. And so there's a dilution to the value of the individual teams.
I agree. Sucks for New Zealand, but it's... Yeah, when you think about it, the relationship and how it works at the moment is they probably need us more than we need them. The same way that when we look at India, we're like, hey, can we sort of get a little bit more of a buy-in here or whatever, because it clearly benefits us as the one that's reaching as opposed to settling. But I know what you mean about the time zone. You think, well, yeah, that might be great on Saturday or Sunday or whatever, but on Monday to Friday when everyone's at work, well, that's great. There's a game that's going on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but where the majority of the eyeballs are, and people are at work, people aren't watching it anyway. So I don't know how it necessarily helps your viewership on that front. The other thing is, Teddy, who's the best T20 player in New Zealand?
I think he just scored the most runs in the Big Bash.
He's playing in our competition anyway.
So my point actually was, you don't need another team. You could just do a deal with the Players Association. Say you can play as locals if you're picked up, you know, and you treat the Super Smash as a little bit more of a minor league, let's say. You can play it earlier in the year, and teams have an option to pick up players as local players, but it doesn't mean that they need a local team, which comes with a lot of cost, infrastructure, etc. And whether, you know, you sell that off and, you know, that solves problems, but I think it caused a lot of problems as well. So, you know, that's kind of me thinking through that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Not saying, you know, much as it relates to this whole process, because I still think it's very early days.
The other thing is, too, it's another time zone. It's 3 hours away, and the Sixers aren't going to get a day to train and everything else. So
Perfect.
All right, we're done with that for now. So we'll continue to follow what happens on that front with the potential sale of the BBL. Are you any more, like, you give me a percentage, like likely sale, unlikely sale? Are we 80-20? Are we 97-3? Are we 50-50? Like, what's the chances of these things being sold? Or is it still up in the air?
It's very much up in the air. Okay. One thing I do know is cricket needs to solve its balance sheet issue. And so there's a whole, we talked about last week, there's a whole range of inputs into that, and this is one of them. And, you know, the people on a far higher pay grade than me can work through understanding how that's going to work.
So that's like three people. on the high pay grade than Teddy. We'll see if they can work through it. When it comes to Bangladesh, this is another tricky topic, but unfortunately they are out of the World Cup. It depends which media report you read as to what happens, whether they've been kicked out, whether they've boycotted, what's happened. One thing we know for sure is they're not going to play in the T20 World Cup, and as a result, the third largest fan base in world cricket are going to be ostracised from the tournament. So the PCB chair, Mohsin Nafki, who is, of course, the head of the Pakistan Cricket Board, said it's been made clear that Bangladesh have had an injustice done to them. You can't say for one country they can do whatever they want, and for the others they have to do the complete opposite, which is, I think, the obvious pull that a lot of people go to is the comparison between, you know, the India-Pakistan relationship and obviously what it means for Bangladesh here. Pakistan, by the way, were the only other cricket board that actually sided with Bangladesh when it went to a vote. So all the others, the other 14, including Australia, voted in favour of the ICC. So Scotland replaced them in the tournament. They'll be grouped with their European friends, England and Italy, along with the West Indies and Nepal. So this tournament is due to begin on the 7th of February. We did touch on it the other day that this was a possibility, yeah, and all of a sudden they've moved quick and Bangladesh are out, Scotland are in.
Yeah, it's sad, and maybe it's worth just kind of rewiring the backstory here, and you're probably better placed than I am. But I'd love to know, you know, the internal machinations of how Cricket Australia vote in this kind of situation, because it's not best for cricket that this is occurring, and the only thing that it could possibly mean is, you know, to say, oh, we were backed into a corner because at the last moment, you know, we can't have all these games reshifted for a whole range of reasons. I think that feels like a bit of a cop out. I'm not close enough to it, but I know the World Cup should be inclusive of those that have qualified. I did see the World Players Association put out a pretty strong statement. The WCA has become increasingly concerned by broader trends in the sport, including agreements not being honoured, rights being eroded, and a lack of meaningful consultation with players and their representatives. All this amounts to a careless approach to people that should not belong in cricket. It also highlights significant issues with the game's existing operating model at a global level.
Yep.
These issues, if continue to be left unaddressed, weaken trust, unity, and ultimately the health and future of the game.
Yeah, but the part of that's on the players. So I mean that the one thing that at least playing for their national bodies and under that umbrella meant that a lot of them, at least in this part of the world, are protected by their unions and everything else that goes along with it. Whereas you start going to play in franchise leagues, there ain't no new unions there. So as a result, that, you know, that is contagious, and that's how sports starts to get governed. And all of a sudden, you know, yes, it's great to take the paycheck, but all of a sudden these kind of decisions are made and there's political influences and everything else that goes along with it, and you're on the wrong side of things. Where, you know, you want to back that horse and take the check that comes with it, then that's the fallout.
No, that's a fair view. It was just more that the words were pretty pointed in one direction. That was at the BCCI. Anyway, is it worth giving a bit of backstory, or do you think we covered it last week?
Yeah, I mean, it depends who you ask on all this. I mean, from a cricketing standpoint, obviously there was the Bangladeshi player that was pulled from the Kolkata Knight Riders. Essentially, the BCCI asked the Kolkata Knight Riders to release him. He went out of the tournament. Then we basically heard conversations about, you know, Pakistan saying they didn't feel safe as a result to go to India. They withdrew all TV rights, so you can't watch the IPL anymore in Bangladesh. And really, there was a conflict immediately between the two cricket boards. Bangladesh said, hey, we don't want to go. We want the same deal Pakistan have, which means we're going to play our games in Sri Lanka. And then eventually the ICC said, hey, that's not possible. The ICC did cite the fact that the security concerns that they were citing weren't realistic. So whatever kind of research that they'd done into that front, they didn't feel like it was the same kind of same kind of risk, for example, as an Indian team setting foot on Pakistan soil, or Pakistan travelling to India, the same way it would be for Bangladesh to come over and play their games. And as a result, they said, hey, look, you're in or you're out. Essentially, Bangladesh held out for a better deal. They said, right, you're out then, Scotland's in. There's a religious crossover in all of this. There's political tensions, obviously, between the two countries. I think if you ask people in India where it started and how it started, they would talk about, you know, the treatment of Hindus in Bangladesh. Bangladesh people would say, well, that's not necessarily the case. They started it. So this, I mean, it depends how deep you want to dig on this particular issue.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good broad brushstroke, and I think you're right. It depends. Yeah, there'll be many versions of people's truths, and you know, I'm sure something in the middle is probably more accurate. But all I know and my reflection is it's just sad for the game.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
I mean, and so when we get to this point in time, it feels like we actually need to rewire how this game does get governed, and we know that the power, you know, lies with a certain body, and it's just not possible to push that in any other direction.
Yep, no, it's not good for cricket. I think we know that for sure. Elsewhere in the world, so well on to England. They won their first ODI away from home under Brendan McCullum in their 11th game on what they then described as the worst wicket that they've ever played on. So they turned on that pretty quick. And hey, makes the MCG, makes Perth look pretty good in the Test series.
You beat my punchline. They're basically bad wicket specialists now.
Good on England. They had a win there.
Good on them. Yeah, good on England.
Meanwhile, India in their T20 series, this team is an absolute bustle. I mean, we mentioned it the other day. They've now won 32 of their last 37 T20 internationals. Abhishek Sharma did it again. So 14 balls for his 50. It was the fastest half century in T20 internationals second fastest by an Indian in T20 internationals. So unassailable 3-0 lead. 11 straight series or tournament that they've won. So yeah, red hot favourite leading into the tournament. And as we've touched on a couple of times, it feels like it's India, Australia up the top, and then a fair gap to everybody else.
If you think about the players to come back into that team, and namely Finn Allen, how much of a difference does that make to New Zealand?
A little bit. I mean, they haven't really got close, though, in the three games.
You need him. He could win a game off his own bat.
How's he go with Jasper Bumrah bowling to him as opposed to some of the BBL guys?
That's true. I mean, who would have thought that Jack Edwards isn't Jasper Bumrah?
If I said to you too that this Indian team, so think about, for so long we've become accustomed to Virat and Rohit Sharma and these kind of name brand players, Sanju Samson, who albeit's out of form at the moment, he's got a little bit of work to do, and Abhishek Sharma, who's probably the hottest batsman in T20 cricket at the moment. You got Ishan Kishan, who's the young talented wicketkeeper, Suri Kumar Yadav, Shivam Dubey, and then Raninku Singh, and then Hardik Pandya. So there, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, Hardik Pandya, I'm a bit more familiar with his work. And then the bowling lineup is Harshit Rana, Ravi Bishnoi, Kuldeep Yadav, and Jasper Bumrah. So there's a lot of names there that, I mean, if you're a fan of the IPL, you'll be familiar with a lot of their work, but there'll be casual cricket fans that will tune in for this tournament going, gee, I don't recognise too many of these Indian names, and yet they are world-class at what they do and proper T20 specialists that they're a whole lot to deal with.
Well said. I think India probably were early adopters of realising that their best ODI players were not their best T20 players. And Australia, you know, probably were 3 or 4 years behind them. And so they're very comfortable blooding young T20 native players, players that grew up in the IPL that actually don't harbour any desire to play any other format of the game. They may, but their primary format is T20 cricket, and they are specialists, much like Australia has now moved to with a Tim David, et cetera, et cetera. But they were early adopters of this. And so that is a T20 native team, and my goodness, that's a scary prospect to play them at home. I said last week, I think the only team that can beat them is an in-form Australia. That doesn't mean that will be the final, by the way. We know that World Cups do funny things to teams. So I think this iteration could be as good a World T20 World Cup as we've seen in a while.
The Aussie under-19s, they're through to the last of their Super 6 games. I mean, they're almost assured to get through to the Final Four, even if they lose this match against the West Indies. They're also out of Namibia, so the tournament now heads to Zimbabwe. So they'll play their last Super 6 game there. And then that's also the same setting for the semi-final and the final. So the boys just chugging along beautifully at the moment, yet to drop a game. We mentioned Will Melichuk last week. Will Byram, he's the guy that bobbed up during the week. 5 for 14 as Sri Lanka were rock and rolled for just 58.
And late replacement. Wasn't meant to be on the tour. Son of Paul Byram, who many people in you know, Sydney cricket, went to the cricket academy. Big, tall, fast bowler. Was very, very talented.
And Steve Hogan is the third leading run scorer in the tournament. I love a kid coming through named Steve. Good. That's it's It's great. The other thing
came to my attention, because, you know, I watched a bit of the game against Japan. I was like, oh, these Japanese players have a nice forward defense. I think 9 of them are based in Australia and play one club or something in Brisbane. Like, it's not a Tokyo-based team, put it that way.
Okay. That's good context.
They did better than the Sri Lankans. The Sri Lankans got 50. The Japanese got 200.
Yeah, and just on the SA20, by the way, so another orange team won here, and they've dominated this tournament. The Sunrisers Eastern Cape, they've won 3 of the 4 editions, and Marco Jansen was the player of the match with 4 overs, 1 maiden, 3 for 13 in the final up against the Capitals. I was interested, the Capitals, by the way, aren't the capital of South Africa. They're like the Pretoria Capitals or something, but obviously they just have the owners from the Delhi Capitals, and as a result, that's why they have that name.
You mean the Perth Capitals? Oh, no, that's...
Not yet. Diewald Brevis, who I saw make that eye-popping 100 up in Darwin against the Australians. He scored 100 in the final for the losing team. In the end, they only made 158, and that was run down with 4 balls to spare. After being 4 for 48, Sunrisers got there on the back of Tristan Stubbs, who's the captain, and a guy named Matthew Bretzky, who's actually played a little bit of cricket for Northants over in the county system under Darren Lehman, and he can absolutely whack them. So they got a sneaky good team, South Africa, as you'd expect. So look out for them too in the World Cup starting in a fortnight.
I know that we don't have a Champions League like we used to, and that was a great competition. It's hard with the IPL teams and different people around the world. But one thing that should definitely happen is the Scorchers should play the Capitals.
Ah,
a 3-game series. Whatever that looks like, just have 1 week of having, like, a Southern Hemisphere champion, and I don't know, throw your Georgie Pie Smash winner in if you really want to. But it doesn't really interest me. I think it'd be good for TV.
Also, while people are just screaming at their podcast as they're listening along to this, what is the capital of South Africa, by the way?
Ooh, you're testing me. I'm going to say Pretoria.
Yeah, so it's one of 3. So South Africa, I don't know if you remember this from school, but basically they have 3 different capitals. Pretoria is the administrative capital, but then Cape Town is the legislative capital, and then Bloemfontein is the judicial capital. So as a result, they have 3 different capitals. So technically they are the Pretoria capitals, which sort of make 1/3 makes sense, but it's not the same thing. Yeah. What I'm trying to say is still correct.
That is good. That is, I mean...
What I'm trying to say is still correct.
I love that you brought that to the table.
There'll be other people out there thinking, I wouldn't have thought twice about it, but here we are at the end of the pod. All right, that's us done. Teddy, we're out of here. We'll be back again on Friday. Of course, every Monday and Friday, right through to the end of the T20 World Cup. We'll be back with some cricket to talk about from somewhere in the world as Australia are about to start these bilateral games against Pakistan in the lead-up to the tournament. And the one thing that I should have mentioned, maybe hold this over for Friday, biggest story that was missed all week was Nathan Ellis's hamstring injury. So that's a concern ahead of the World Cup if he's done a hammy and it's a 21-day string. We need him. So we'll talk more about that and every other issue going on in world cricket come Friday. I'll chat to you then.
Later, Corb.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.